I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. So have you ever looked around your house and thought, this dishwasher, this stroller, this printer, these tennis shoes could be so much better? My guests today argue that a tremendous amount of creativity and a lot of the work on items that really matter to us have not come from companies, not come from the top down, but from people who really didn't like the products the way they were and became part of the user innovation revolution. And I'm joined first by Eric von Hippel, professor at MIT's Sloan School, and Carlos Baldwin, professor at Harvard Business School. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Delighted to be here.
So, Eric von Hippel, I know that you've been studying user innovation for a really long time. So first, before we get into some really interesting cases of it, tell people, what is user innovation?
Okay, so consumer innovation is a form of user innovation. User innovation is when people develop things to use it rather than to sell it. And it can be a firm making things for itself or consumers, as you say, making things for themselves. And historically, this has been something that has not been considered to be major or possible. But what recently we have done with colleagues is to do surveys, national representative surveys in the UK, US, and Japan, and found out it's absolutely huge. In fact, it challenges the scale of all the producer innovation done for consumers. So it's absolutely massive. It's the dark matter.
And we really think of things, I think, as coming from the top down. Is it Procter & Gamble says, well, here's our new, you know, toaster, or Gillette says, here's the new razor. And your argument is, wow, no, there's a lot of things that have come from the bottom up, and we just don't realize it.
Absolutely right. I mean, basically, consumers innovate, and they're behind many of the innovations that manufacturers like Procter & Gamble make, but consumers have no incentive to advertise. So basically what happens is Procter & Gamble sees that something has spread in the user community, then say, oh, I guess we'll make it. And then they say, buy our XYZ. And before you know it, everybody thinks, that they're the innovators.
Carlos Baldwin from Harvard Business School, how do big companies deal with the fact that so many people on the ground are fixing products and tinkering with them and trying to make them better?
Well, Kara, I think there's been a real sea change in the last decade and a half. And even though user innovation has been going on for a very long time, it became important really with the rise of cheap computing and cheap communication, which allowed users to band together and share their ideas and break up the work into modules and bring those modules together. And that happened first on a large scale in the software community with the phenomenon called open source. Originally, the companies were actively hostile to this new way of doing things. And we have Steve Ballmer of Microsoft saying Linux and open source code base under the GPL was a cancer.
And this is fear, it feels like,
fear.
Right? That people are creating things that are competing with his products.
And they sowed fear in reverse. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt about the quality of these products, about did they infringe on various patents that Microsoft had. But at the same time, other companies began to see possibilities to tap the creativity of users, to find people that had great ideas that they didn't know where they were, to figure out who was really good at design. And so forward-looking companies began to design strategies that used this new source, used the dark matter. And they would segregate their designs into those pieces that they would control and those pieces that the users would actively work on.
Eric von Hippel, let's talk about a couple of products that maybe everybody knows, but they do not realize that they came from users, from consumers themselves, not somebody in a corporate office somewhere who thought of it.
Sure. So a wonderful example, and an entire area really, is sports. Because all sports, effectively, all sporting equipment is entirely developed by users. And you see, you know, something that might be not familiar to many listeners, the very modern things like kite surfing and wingsuits. But if you look back at something like, mountain biking, the story is always the same in every sport. What happens is that the users start to do something and the producers say, that's really stupid. That's not a market. Nobody would ever want to do that. And then it begins to spread amongst communities of users. They say, whoa, this is really good. I think I'll do that too, whether it's a skateboard or whatever. And then eventually manufacturers come in and they say, okay, I guess we'll make something like that. And then the cycle begins again. So like when you see, for instance, in mountain biking, what happened first was they rode down mountains. And so users made more robust bikes. Producers followed. And then the users started to jump. And when you jump, you need suspensions. They came down. They said, ouch, this really hurts. So the users made new suspensions. Manufacturers once again said, this is the stupidest thing we ever heard. Who the hell would ever do that? And then that became very popular. And then manufacturers introduced their versions of what the users had pioneered.
So mountain bikes originally didn't exist. It was people just putting thicker tires or whatever on their existing bikes and saying, I'm not going to use this on, you know, paved roads. I'm going to do whatever. I'm going to go up to a mountain and take it down.
Yeah, well, what happened was they took their regular bikes that Dad gave them for Christmas up the Mount Tamalpais, as it turns out, rode them down to the bottom, and they were a piece of junk. So they couldn't return them, you know. So they actually built their own using motorcycle brakes and so on. So they actually built their own to be really sturdy. Yeah.
And I know something we see all over the place, the baby jogger.
Yeah, that's so cool.
You know, I think he was actually a journalist, right? He just came up with the baby jogger. Talk about how that happened.
Well, the story goes that it was Phil Batchelor, I think was his name, and his wife, as I understand it, said, stroll the baby. And he said, I want to jog. She said, stroll the baby or die. And he said, well, okay, you convinced me. And in that case, then there's a picture of him actually in his garage and taking the wheels off his other kids' bikes. I assume the kids were old enough so they didn't need those bikes anymore, and building the baby jogger. And then he ran around the streets with this thing. And everybody who saw him said, man, I want one of those too. Which is very interesting because Sonali Shah, a colleague of ours, has recently in a Kaufman study showed that 50%, 46.6 actually, percent of ventures founded on new innovations are founded by users. So it's not only that the users innovate and spread them for free, which they certainly do. Many of the things that governments love to tax new companies are also formed by users. And in Phil Batchelor's case, again, he was running around. Everybody said, whoa, this is really great. I want one too. He said, fine, I'll start a company. And so that's how that started.
Let's talk a little bit about how long this has been around, this idea of things coming from really smart people out there, but not necessarily the people who are at the top of organizations. A few months ago, I talked to Kareem Lakhani from Harvard Business School, and he pointed out that crowdsourcing is nothing new. Let's listen to it.
I'm going to take us back to the Renaissance. So this notion that we can actually get anybody in the world to solve our problems has been actually practiced quite a bit in the Renaissance period when governments wanted to get problems solved. So for instance, the dome in Florence at the cathedral came about because they wanted to run a contest around the best design for the dome, and the dome had to be unsupported. All the architects at the time said, this can't be done. So the tower stood open for 50 years. They ran a contest, and then Brunelleschi came about, who's a goldsmith with the design. And so this notion was that we as organizations may not have all the best people working for us for a particular problem. And the best thing for us to do is to actually let anybody in the world participate and create a solution for us.
So Carlos Baldwin from Harvard Business School, this is really, in a lot of senses, a very old idea that's been around for a long time, that the smartest people may not necessarily be the people in the positions of power.
And this idea was put into modern form by Bill Joy, a founder of Sun Microsystem, who said, not all smart people work for you, and you must take that into account in devising your strategy. I think, although the phenomena has been around a long time, the reach of it has vastly expanded. And so at this point, companies really can't afford not to look out there, but they face problems. They don't know where people are who might have good ideas. They don't know whether they're any good at what they do. And people have different motivations. Not all people want to work for an existing manufacturer. So these crowdsourcing techniques and tournaments are good at getting people to self-identify. You get to evaluate their quality after the fact. It brings in people whose motivation isn't necessarily to work for a big company.
And we're joined by Benjamin Mako Hill, PhD candidate at MIT and a user innovator, one of those smart people out there working on things. So I wonder, do you see, I know you've worked in some sense on Canon cameras, on open source software. Do you see a user innovation revolution going on?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you look at open source more generally, you just see really hundreds of thousands of examples of projects of users either sort of solving their own problems and offering them out to people, or very often working together and collaborating towards the production of really incredible examples of sort of platforms for innovation as well.
So talk a little bit about the stuff that you've done with Canon, why people wanted in the first place to try to change what the cameras could do.
Yeah, so there's this. So there's a great example of a project called CHDK. It stands for the Canon Hackers Dev Development Kit, or Dev Kit. And what it is is a way to modify the firmware that runs on Canon cameras. And very originally, it was actually born out of frustration by users of Canon cameras who were frustrated by some of the sort of market segmentation strategies. That is sort of Canon's plan to make a whole bunch of different types of cameras and sort of charge people more for certain ones and to include certain features in some and not others. A lot of users, a feature that a lot of users wanted was what's called shooting raw photographs. And it's raw is basically just raw sensor data. On cheap cameras, the raw sensor data is just thrown away after the compressed image is made. And a number of users who wanted the ability to have this raw sensor data so they could do a lot of sort of darkroom style effects were able to sort of basically hack their cameras. They were able to modify the firmware such that they could do this. And when they shared that change on online forums and communities, what happened was is a broad interest of other sort of photography enthusiasts who had Canon cameras and who were, for example, using that piece of software or that modification on their cameras, were interested in building a new functionality, sort of got together and kept adding to it. They actually ended up building a platform for writing new functionality into Canon, into the firmware more
broadly.
And
it allows people to take all different kinds of pictures than they might normally take.
That's right. So what started out is just a basic sort of, attempt to shoot these sort of darkroom style negatives with digital cameras sort of ended up with this community of people who are doing lightning photography. So people who are doing ultra high speed photography, now sort of three times faster than the fastest commercially available digital cameras previously on $50 point and shoots. All kinds of interesting features. I mean, like the ability to shoot these high dynamic range photos, just tons and tons of stuff. A paper will come out in a sort of scientific photography journal, and within a day, it will be supported using the CHDK platform. Mm. So all kinds of crazy innovation, including things that, not only things that the sort of camera companies hadn't thought of, but even things that the camera companies had previously thought was impossible, like physically impossible on their cameras.
So we are taking your calls. Call us at 877-301-8970. Have you seen user innovation in your own life? And if you were fixing a product, if you could fix one thing, what would it be? What is that one piece of clothing or electronics or furniture that you think this really needs to be improved? 877-301-8970, or you can tweet us at Boss Public Radio. And Eric Von Hippel, I can see you want to get in here.
Yeah, I want to say one thing more generally, which is that We've said so far that consumer innovation is huge, it's really important, but it's also a good thing. I mean, that's what we have to understand. Despite the resistance of companies, many companies are adapting, it's a good thing. Users get to make exactly what they want for themselves. They're empowered. They don't have to buy and adapt whatever the company sells them. That's one thing. But another thing is it's better for social welfare. And the reason for that is that when a user innovates, a user typically gives it away. And the reason the user gives it away is because they are benefiting from use value. They don't have to benefit from selling it. If I make a mountain bike and I use it, that's what I did it for. Now, the result of that is that from producer's point of view, number one, we have a new partitioning of the innovation process where the producer really can let the user innovate and produce some of the things. That's to the benefit of the producer. But at the same time, the fact that it's free, that users can make their own copies, puts a price discipline on the producer. That's good for social welfare. Then the next final piece is that basically things like mountain bikes would not exist if there weren't things to do with them. That's called a complement. All the techniques don't go through manufacturers at all. There's this giant parallel peer-to-peer teaching of how to ride a mountain bike. The only reason that manufacturers can get monies on mountain bikes is because those techniques exist. So in a way, the producers are taking some of the innovations that users develop and selling them, but they could not exist without complementary user innovations.
Eric von Hippel, professor at MIT Sloan School, Carlos Baldwin, professor at Harvard Business School, and Benjamin Mako Hill, PhD candidate at MIT and a user innovator. We're going to be right back to talk more about user innovation, and we will take your calls. If you were fixing a product, what would it be? And have you seen user innovation at play in your own life? Call us at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. We're talking about creativity springing up from you, the consumer, rather than trickling down from the corporate suites of companies. Are we witnessing a user innovation revolution? And what would that mean for all the products that we buy? We're taking your calls at 877-301-8970. Where have you seen user innovation in your own life? And we've got a bunch of calls from people who want to join us. Well, let me go back for a second to Carlos Baldwin, professor at Harvard Business School. This is a real change for companies. Talk about a company that did not deal well with people trying to take their products and improve upon them.
Well, Sony. Sony makes a little dog, a robot dog called the Aibo. As with the Canon camera, as soon as it came out, people wanted to teach the dog to do new tricks that weren't in the Sony software that the dog was pre-programmed with. So they created a community and began to post their ideas and solutions to a website, and Sony sent a cease and desist order to the owner of the website, basically using the DMCA, which is a pretty hefty legal threat, to say, you can't do this. Not really a very friendly thing to do.
And whatever happened to the little robotic Sony dog?
Actually, there was a lot of user pushback and a bit of a firestorm. And now Sony reluctantly made parts of its code open, publishes a software developer kit, but for non-commercial use only. So they've been brought kicking and screaming into the modern age.
Let's get to some of our callers here who've been waiting patiently on the phone. Darnell from Wareham, tell us, have you done any user innovation yourself?
I have done some research online, and I like to think of myself as a local inventor. I have a whole bunch of ideas, but the one I just wanted to bring up quickly is recently I've been doing some research in thermoelectric generators, and I was thinking a great invention would be to make a portable fire pit for camping, so that way you can have electricity at the campsite. And I just wanted to throw that out there because I was, you know, hearing about ideas earlier. And
great.
I love the program. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. And let's go to, do we have Jay in Portsmouth? Let's see if we can get Jay in Portsmouth. Oh, here he is. Jay, what do you think should be improved?
Well, I think everything should be improved. Mine is more a general comment of sort of the innovation ethic and production ethic. From a bag of clothespins that I went through recently, and not one single clothespin opened without snapping and breaking, to software on computers that are so complicated they can't be used, I find that there's more and more a sense that innovators and manufacturers, producers, are putting things out there that really just don't work. They don't even do the simple or singular thing they're intended to do. And I wish there were a more sense of a general ethic of innovation and production for quality that at least does what they're supposed to do.
Thanks so much, Jay. Eric von Hippel, let me go to you here. I mean, you hear people sort of wanting to perfect what they see in their own lives and thinking maybe that the things from companies are not what they could be.
Right. So the thing that is, in a sense, very helpful here is that increasingly you no longer have to do with what companies make for you. If you are stuck with a bunch of clothespins and you find their quality defective, in a way, it used to be that you had to be stuck with those clothespins. But now, increasing numbers of people can just print their own clothespins to their own specifications on 3D printers that cost $1,000 each. So the real lesson here is that the ethics will improve by market forces. Users are the ones who will choose what they want when they have the option. And increasingly, they have the option to make it themselves if no one else will make it for them.
And Mako Hill, I want to come to you on this. But first, I'm going to play, we heard Eric von Hippel talk about 3D printers. And we, just a few months ago, had Candace Cabe on this program, a young innovator who founded this company called Day to Night Convertible Heels. And she is describing to me here the process of making the first prototype of her shoe, which she made, we always think of 2D printers, but she made with a 3D printer. Here she is talking about it.
So this was our very first prototype that we ever did, which was about a year and a half ago. And it's basically plastic that was made with rapid prototyping, which is a process called 3D printing. And you make a 3D model on your computer. And from that model, you can print out an exact replica of what you've made. And it takes about 7 hours to print one heel.
Wow.
And it's printed in layers of plastic. So it's basically positive and negative space as if you were to stack up, you know, 250 pieces of paper and cut it to the exact shape that you want it. So it's really cool that you can have this in your hand. You know, years back, the only way to get a physical product was to make a mold of it and to mass produce it.
Mako Hill, is technology really changing the landscape here, the game for the individual?
I think the answer is absolutely yes. It's sort of in a couple different ways. On the one hand, you have the technologies necessary to actually sort of, you know, build the innovation. So, I mean, you know, we already mentioned, if one of the callers mentioned software, right? And software is this example of, you know, anyone with a laptop sort of capable of running software is also has all the tools necessary to change it, right? You go into any software company, it's a bunch of people sitting around working on laptops, right? And so in that sense, the sort of the tools of production have been sort of distributed such that people can solve their own problems. And that's why you see this explosion of free software, of open source, right? Is because you know, when I was 12 years old, I started participating in some of these free software open source communities. And it's because I was using software and I was just as annoyed that these pieces of software didn't do this basic thing or they had a bug. And I realized that when I use software whose source code I had access to, right, and which I could change, that I could take advantage of that. I could fix things when they didn't work. And that very often through things like 3D printing, but also through sort of design technologies, digital design technologies and digital fabrication technologies, we're seeing those tools being spread both to wider numbers of people, but also across a much wider sort of types of products, right? But also communication technologies are making it possible for people to collaborate and communicate much more effectively in ways than before, so that when one person, you know, finds a way to make their camera do something, they can release it to other people and everyone else can benefit, and people that maybe have a related problem or that can sort of use that as a stepping stone to solving their own problem can benefit from that as well.
Carlos was talking earlier about Steve Ballmer from Microsoft saying that, you know, open source is sort of evil and a little bit of a cancer. I mean, when you produce open source software and if people are always going in and fixing the problems, isn't that an awfully big threat to a big behemoth like Microsoft, who's trying to build their own software and sell you Windows so you can use that to operate your computer?
I mean, I think that it's on some level, it is a threat to Microsoft. Or at least it's a threat to the way in which Microsoft has done business in the past. At the moment, Microsoft has sort of changed their mind a little bit. They're actually contributing a lot to the Linux kernel and to a bunch of other projects. It is a threat to the way in which they've built software in the past, which is to say, we do it internally. We have our sort of expert engineers build this thing, and then we sort of give it to you, and you just sort of use it. But I think that it's certainly not a threat that is concerns most of the people doing this, right? When I have a piece of software that doesn't work, I want to fix the bug, right? And if that and I think that most people who sort of are so concerned with the fact that their software doesn't work, they just want to fix it. And if that happens to sort of lead to a complicated business decision for some firm out in Seattle, I think
So, you know, you talked about sort of hacking Canon cameras to make them do more exciting things, take pictures of lightning, pictures at high speeds, do all these things that Canon didn't really mean for them to do necessarily. How did Canon deal with that?
So it's interesting. There was a little write-up of this in the short version is that Canon hasn't responded. And even when the New York Times did a little story about CHGK a few years ago, and Canon sort of tries to say as little as possible. They say things like installing software on your camera could damage the device. No one's come forward and said it ever has, but it's of course a sort of possibility. I mean, the short version is the Canon doesn't really know what to do, and this has come out from Canon knows what's going on. They're monitoring what's going on in this community, and actually a number of innovations which have come out first in CHGK or in within that community have sort of shown up in Canon cameras later.
They're learning a little bit from what's happening, but they haven't sent out like cease and desist, because there are times, you know, Carlos was taking Sony and the little robot. They're not saying just so Canon, stop what you're
I think
doing.
Canon has mixed feelings. On the one hand, CHGK only works for Canon cameras. It won't work on an Nikon camera. It's good. It's selling cameras, and it's a great source of innovation. On the other hand, it is sort of attacking some part of their business strategy, which is that you can buy the cheapest camera and load on CHGK and get basically all of the features in all the more expensive cameras. It won't make you have a better lens or a better sensor, which is part of something that they can encourage people to buy more expensive cameras. But they sort of have mixed feelings about it. And as a result, their position, and I don't know, part of this is sort of their corporate culture, and part of this is just sort of their confusion with the situation is just to sort of be quiet.
So we've talked a little bit about the threat that this posed to big companies, but I also wonder what kind of opportunity it poses. And actually, last week we had the senior vice president of Under Armour, which a lot of people know, big sporting company, their innovation lab. And he talked about that they really try to have this sort of open approach to innovation and to let consumers contribute ideas. Let's listen to what Kevin Haley, the senior vice president of Under Armour's innovation lab, had to say.
We want and encourage outside inventors, companies, really universities, anyone to bring us the greatest ideas out there, and then we will bring them to the consumer. We had compression short with this very elastic base material, but then a very strong, almost elastic band that crisscrosses in an X over the pelvis and around the back and over the hips. And it just holds the core together in a way that is something you really have to experience to understand. But we saw it popping up in NHL locker rooms and on some college football teams, you know, one here, one there. And the gentleman who was running it came to us and said, effectively, I've been working on this for 20 years. It's a fantastic product. I have no distribution. I have no marketing. I have no brand. He was struggling to sell many units at a $30 price point. And so we actually got involved and made it a little more commercial, just in terms of comfort and appearance, but using his overall concept. And the great thing about it is that when push came to shove at the end, the product was no longer covered by his patents, but we really said, you know what? We're going to pay you the royalty anyhow because we want to encourage people to bring us these great ideas.
Carlos Baldwin from Harvard Business School. There is that sort of school of thought of you really should open up because there are some, I mean, I think it's interesting here that he said, well, we saw it popping up in professional sports locker rooms here and there. And then we thought maybe there's something to this. Yeah.
So this is really, I think, where companies need to go in today's age, to embrace this new phenomenon, this newly powerful surge of creativity. But it's very important. He said he didn't take the innovation from the original inventor, which, talking about ethics, has been a pattern in the past. And he said we didn't do it because we want to continue the reciprocal benefit of the innovators innovate, come to us as their executor, and know they'll be treated fairly. And I think that's a very, very important lesson here, that just grabbing the IP, the intellectual property, isn't the best way to go.
And have you seen that, where big companies sort of swoop in and sort of bigfoot an idea and say, thank you very much, we'll take that, and not give you any money for it necessarily?
Yeah. It's been going on for hundreds of years.
Really, yeah.
Innovators sue over this. There was a windshield wiper suit, I think, where the mechanical reapers were taken from user innovation 100 years ago.
Eric von Hippel, have companies sort of realized that this community of user innovators can really help them?
Well, what companies have to realize, they're starting to, but what companies have to realize is that they're not going to get driven out of business by this. Innovation is a cost. And companies can still make money by economies of scale. Basically, remember what that Under Armour guy said. You know, he said, well, this guy has no distribution, no brand, whatever, right?
Right. We've got stores. We can put it in our stores, right?
Exactly right. So what's really happening here is that if companies get used to the idea that innovation is often done better outside by users who are closer to the need, and the next thing that happens is by the diffusion of those innovations, you can see which are the good ones. Like what he said was, it popped up in NFL locker rooms, right? So in other words, people were finding it useful. It
right.
wasn't just a random idea.
Right.
Then the company comes in, they have a higher chance of success, and they have the advantage of distribution and brand and so on to make money. And then, as Carlos says, they really have to understand how to work with these communities so the communities don't feel ripped off.
And Mako Hill, I know the Lego company is actually, interestingly, a company that said, there's a lot of innovators out there, and we're not going to freak out by the fact that they are doing some innovation. Talk about what Lego has done.
So Lego's actually done this a few times in a few different ways, but they've absolutely done some of this work. So I mean, one example that of something that Lego has done is that they have obviously people buy lots of these Lego packs which contain particular pieces in them, and then they sort of reassemble them into their own ideas of things that they might like to see. And that Lego sort of created an online platform where sort of Lego fans could sort of design, sort of share their designs, sort of build their designs and model them up online, and then share them to other people. And that, at least initially, people could also then order those from Lego as well. And of course, they'd sell all the pieces that they were the kits.
And Eric von Hippel, do you think that companies increasingly, I mean, what's the trend? Are companies turning inward? Are they willing to look outwards and do what Lego did and say, there's a lot of good ideas out there that people in this building maybe don't have.
Right. There's great fear among employees. I mean, this was true also amongst the Lego designers. They thought, well, if the users begin to design our products, what do we do? And, you know, so they had to understand that designing toolkits for users to do this more easily, there are other things that they do. But the initial reaction of firms is, no, we like to do things that we, the way we've always done them, this is a threat. It's actually a huge opportunity. It's an opportunity for the firms and the fleeter-footed ones. This is a transition. This is a revolution, a paradigm shift. The fleeter firms will succeed, and the ones that continue to drag their feet, you know, will get outcompeted.
And we see it with Apple. Apple is basically like, here, we have a phone, you design our apps, right? And put it out there to the world.
Well, but the fascinating thing is that initially they resisted.
Oh,
right?
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the users jailbroke the phone. Mako can explain that. It was so cool.
I mean, in the early days before there was an app store, when you sort of got the phone and it did the things that you wanted to do, and it did things that Apple wanted it to do. What you saw was that an enormous proportion of users, by some estimates, up to 25% of all people who bought an iPhone had basically basically attacked the security software on their phone, their own phones, the ones that they had purchased, so that they had so they could hack it, so that they could use it on different networks, so that they could install custom software. And only after there was this like enormously widespread sort of modification of devices did Apple sort of launch a sort of approved way in which users could or user innovators could sort of build new applications and then share them with others.
It's had sort of gone on board with what was happening already.
Yeah. And hugely fought it. I mean, they bricked your phone. Do you remember that phrase?
No.
Yeah, they managed to do things so that if you managed to design or to free up your phone, unlock it, jailbreak it, what they would try to do is, quote, brick it, namely turn it into a brick that was totally unfunctional. How's that for a response?
That's quite a response. Eric von Hippel, professor at MIT's Sloan School, Carlos Baldwin, professor at Harvard Business School, and Benjamin Mako Hill, PhD candidate at MIT and a user innovator. This has been a great discussion. Thank you so much for coming in. And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3. Callie, it looks like you're going to get an insider's look at politics coming up next.
That's right, Kara. I'll be talking to Arnie Arneson and Fergus Cullen about New Hampshire, one of the battleground states. They've got some political twists and turns in the Granite State, which will impact the national election. And we'll find out why Bill Clinton is making his way there.
Interesting. And I'm betting that he's not going to be there for the vegan cuisine in New Hampshire.
That's a bet you're going to win.
I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.
You don't have to be a sports fan to anticipate the start of the 2012 Summer Olympic Games later this week. We're getting in the Olympic spirit by bringing you a series of conversations with some of the athletes you'll be watching. We'll hear their stories of challenge and triumph next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.